Totally Football Show. Today, Dateline Norfolk, as in Norfolking chance, and Norfolk saw that coming. Champions, Man City taking a late summer trip to the Canaries and ending up badly burned. We give Norwich a big hand, something they'll be used to with all those fingers, and ponder what the fuck of the future holds. Elsewhere, we salute the Chelsea Ute, bringing the future with Tomori's goals today, Arsenal, Bournemouth, and so much more in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. That's right, listener, you're joined by the Totally Football Show, which today is composed of Daniel Storey.
Good morning.
Fresh out of the eye. Chelsea State TV mouthpiece, Matt Davis-Adams.
Hello there.
Hi. And the voice of Watford, Emma Saunders.
Good morning.
Five Live Sport, you're doing 606 Euro Leagues and Football Daily podcast.
Correct, yes.
Wow, that sounds good.
But it's great to be here, so thank you for having me.
Oh, great. No, well, that's lovely. And what a great time to be in, because a weekend
is.
That's kind of the early days, you know, you didn't want to give too much importance to any results, but there's a curious look to the table now, isn't there, Daniel?
Yeah, it's both a curious look and also the top seven-ish are about the top seven as we might expect, but it did feel like a significant Premier League weekend, I think.
Five games in, a five-point lead between Liverpool and Man City, as you'll have read, the biggest lead there's ever been at this point in the Premier League. And then the same distance, 5 points, between City in second and Brighton in 16th.
It's crackers. But that's what we're here for, isn't it?
Certainly is, Matt. Only one place we can start today, and that's Norwich's 3-2 win over Man City.
You're listening to the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power.
Newly promoted Norwich City, 8 first-teamers out, already conceded 10 goals in 4 games, facing Man City, the champions, who hadn't lost a game since January, and yet a 3-2 win for the Canaries. We're joined now by Fionn Thomas, writer for When Saturday Comes. Fionn, thanks for being with us. Where would you rank this in terms of all-time greatest Norwich results? Is it up there? Is it beyond what happened with Bayern Munich, Jeremy Goss and all that back in the early 90s?
I think the consensus, because this is something that people have been talking about over the weekend, is that it's the best since Bayern, I think people would say. And in terms of a league match, I think it's probably up there as the best ever, you'd have to say, because of sort of the relative quality of the two teams. And again, with that context of the injury crisis and just the performance, obviously people are talking about Manchester City's defensive errors, which led to the goals. But those sort of came as a result of us pressing them high, discipline in midfield, really closing them down quickly. So we sort of drew those errors out of them. And yeah, as I say, the sort of defensive discipline that kept them really to not that many clear-cut chances.
It was incredible. And of course, prior to this, you went close against Chelsea, you troubled Liverpool a bit, and now that you've cleared those 8 first-teamers out of the side who clearly were the problem in the first place, where are the limits? What's the target, do you think, for Norwich? Realistically, are you dreaming of a return to Europe?
I'd certainly take a return to Europe. And I think people are realistic, given what we went in with. We obviously didn't make that many signings. We certainly didn't make many big money signings, as in no big money signings. So I think we're sort of realistic about that. We just need to sort of finish above the bottom three. I was just looking at the fixtures, and the return game against Man City is the last game of the season. So I think if we were safe going into that game, then we can go and do the double over them. I think we'd all take that. We'll see what happens in the rest of the season. If we pick up any more injuries, we might be in trouble, because we are sort of on the bare bones now. We had 2 keepers on the bench because we didn't have anyone else to go on the bench. So if we can sort of keep people fit without any more sort of huge injuries, that would certainly help in trying to stay up.
Fionn Thomas from When Saturday Comes. Excellent. Tom, our listener, says, given the context, is this Norwich result the biggest shock in Premier League history? And what other shock results compare? I mean, it's huge, isn't it, Matt?
Yeah, I was thinking about this when I saw the tweet. I mean, it's how you define shock. I think he means upset rather than, say, City winning 6-1 at Old Trafford,
right,
or you know, Arsenal losing 8-2 there. And yeah, I think it is, because of the disparity between City, Liverpool and everybody else in the league, and the fact Norwich are newly promoted and they had all these injuries. The only other ones I could think of were Barnsley won at Anfield, I think, in their one season in the Premier League. Remember Swansea winning there too, but I would say that this probably tops a lot, yeah.
All right.
There is an assumption or a supposition that Manchester City can be got at if you press high at the pitch and you unnerve them and force this. Well, if you block the passing lanes, then they kind of, particularly Otamendi and Stones, can panic in possession. But it's a heck of a lot easier said than done for any club, let alone a club, as we said, who had injury problems and is considered one of the weaker teams in the league. So it just shows the discipline and the planning and the coaching that Daniel Farke has initiated. And that's why he didn't want to buy many players this summer, because he thought if he was going to go into the Premier League, he didn't want to be kind of not making things up as they go along, but learning on the job. He wanted to have the exact plans from last season and be able to replicate them.
Wow. Andrew Lang wants a bit of love for Cantwell's goal, which I think is fair, because it incorporates a lot of the great elements of Norwich. You've got Gwendia doing his thing in the middle, and then Pukki with that wonderful square ball for Cantwell with a great finish. Out-citying City.
Yeah, absolutely. I think on the face of things, when Norwich first returned to the Premier League, we were all just here for the Pukki party. But it was just such a complete team performance from Norwich City. I actually think Gwendia, for me, was probably the standout man in that game. He kind of sewed it all together. And Todd Cantwell just seems like he's so enjoying Premier League football. And there's something about Norwich, I think they're just not playing with fear, are they? Because they've come up and immediately everyone had them as the team probably to go straight back down. And week after week, they're doing it against big sides.
Mm. Did Cantwell pick up an injury at the end when he was kind of trying to work his way towards the corner flag?
Maybe. I'm always a little bit suspicious of players getting injuries in the last minutes of games they're winning by one goal and under a bit of pressure.
He was hobbling a bit though,
yeah, maybe a bit of game management, but yeah, I think he'll be all right.
Cantwell, Gwendia and Pukki have got all the headlines. It'd be interesting to see how they're getting on in 2-3 months time when people are a bit more used to how Norwich play and how they play in particular, and whether they can sort of maintain their early season form once they do or don't get found out.
Right.
And Manchester City, they do lose weird games every so often. City, you know, at home to Palace last season, at Newcastle. The problem they've obviously got is in the centre of defence, but I don't think it's a massive reason for talk of crisis or whatever. It's just this kind of thing happens every so often. They lose a game you think they should win.
We say it's a problem with the centre of defence, but it wasn't like City was short of chances. They had 25 shots, 8 on target in that game. I actually think it's City's attacking players that need to take some of the responsibility in this game as well, that they just weren't on the money as they usually are, especially when you watch those dying moments in that game. They had a number of different chances, which you think in any other match the likes of Sterling would have put those goals away,
Gabriel,
but they just
Jesus
didn't.
I think perhaps. yeah that issue at the back is something you pick up on today, Daniel. I think in your winners and losers column on Football 365 where you question why City spent the summer chasing a fullback in João Cancelo when Kyle Walker was already on the books, and yet did nothing to replace Vincent Kompany and any injuries that might occur in the middle.
Yeah, it's funny because at the end of last season, Pep Guardiola was talking about centre-backs, and Kompany's departure was no real shock, certainly to anyone internally at City. And nor is Nicolas Otamendi having these brain fades. And John Stones, sadly, has faded away. His form's faded away a little bit over the last 12 months. So it's no real surprise. It just seemed an odd one, unless they are going to move Walker centre and Cancelo right back maybe. But yeah, it just feels like they doubled up where they didn't need to and are short where they did. No one can legislate for Laporte's six-month injury, obviously, but it's a real blow.
It happens in football. Kyle Walker, who spent most of the game filling in for De Bruyne, as far as I could tell, which was a curious thing, eventually rectified by the entrance of Kevin. Just on the subject of John Stones, the defining characteristic of Pep, everyone says, is that he makes players better, viz. Raheem Sterling, etc. So what up with John Stones?
Well, maybe it's not a Guardiola problem. Maybe it's a John Stones problem.
Are you hinting at an off-field kind of...
Possibly, yeah. Yeah, these things that we never know the full truth of, but around the football whispers, there have been...
You're not doing
things.
A Graeme Souness now, are you?
No, I'm not. Guardiola can coach pretty much anybody, but you can't get inside a player's head and be with them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And sometimes things that take place away from the training ground or the football pitch can impact what happens on it.
There's always the Phil Neville texting technique in terms of getting in a place. I'm just saying.
I think texting is what got him into trouble in the first place.
So. Okay. Moving on then. Drawing a veil over all that and saying Man City have now dropped 5 points already this season and we're only 5 weeks in. Liverpool, meanwhile, have maintained their perfect start with a 3-1 victory at home to Newcastle. We talk about that after this.
Mondays. In terms of popularity, they're up there with Brussels sprouts, dental surgery and Neymar, aren't they? But at Paddy Power, we wanted to do something to make Mondays a bit less Monday. So now Mondays are Money Back Mondays, when we get you, the punters, to nominate your lost football bet on Twitter, using the hashtag Money Back Mondays, to vote in our Monday Twitter poll, and then we refund on the most popular market as a free bet. Paddy Power, home of the Money Back Special. T's and C's apply. No max stake. Refund will be as a free bet. Does not apply to shop bets. 18 plus. BeGambleAware.org.
On Spotify, smart speaker and podcast platforms everywhere, this is the Totally Football Show from Muddy Knees Media.
3-1 Liverpool over Newcastle. We thought Newcastle might cause problems and they started well. What a goal, Emma, by Jethro Williams. How do I say that?
Williams.
Yeah. Williams.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, it was a really, really positive start from Newcastle. Liverpool just took a little while to warm up in this game, and it did seem to all click into place once Origi was injured and Bobby Firmino came onto the pitch. Liverpool fans, it's just a Firmino loving at the moment, isn't it? It's true. Give the ball to Bobby, he will score, or at least play a part.
Bobby Dazzler, no. Everybody from Steve Bruce to someone I read on Twitter, calling him the new Eric Cantona. Why is that? And do you think, as Alex does, Matt, that Bergkamp might be a better comparison in terms of past footballer?
Yeah, potentially. I think Firmino's quite unique, though, because he's got the attributes of a Bergkamp, maybe to a lesser extent a Cantona, but he's the modern footballer in terms of his athleticism as well. So I'm not sure a direct comparison with either of those two particularly works. But he's increasingly becoming the most important of that Liverpool front three. And as Emma says, when Origi's on there, the other two look slightly off their game. Once their mate comes on, everything's fine.
Right. Trent Alexander-Arnold describes him as the glue that holds the team together. And I think it's almost like there's a half effect on Crystal Palace. When he's on the pitch, I just think the belief in the side will automatically grow. And another really nice quote from Janino on Firmino. He says he'd probably get the captaincy at Liverpool, but the trouble is there's so many different players at Liverpool that kind of, well, they could be made captains themselves. They hold those kind of leadership skills. Mm. But he's just a complete player.
Matt, would you give us your Steve Bruce impression?
I can do, yeah. What
would he have said?
Read his direct quotes after the game, but if he was comparing Firmino, you know, to anybody, would have to be maybe Eric Cantona, but a word for our supporters who were magnificent today, and the chairman, who, be fair to him, has been fantastic with me. It's all about putting a pause in a sentence sometimes where you wouldn't normally have one, you know?
Brilliant.
That was beautiful, Matthew.
It was.
Closed my eyes and dreamed of payback and think of Steve.
And Liverpool roll on. They'll be off next to Naples on Tuesday. Presumably getting changed in the bus or something. I'm not sure how that's going to work because the issues at San Paolo. But yeah, you can find out on BT Sports Goal Show, of course, that and all the rest of the Tuesday and Wednesday delights. We'll be previewing that Champions League fixture and all the midweek games in Tuesday's Totally Football Show European edition, of course, with Rafael, Julien, Alvaro and James. Next up on this show, a bit of this.
Here's a game. He gives it to Mount. Is he going to get his customary goal? Mason Mount, yes he is. Thank you very much and good night.
Sweet sound of Matt Davis Adams there talking about Chelsea doing a number on Wolves. We mentioned the more normal look to the top of the table with the top seven being the kind of big six plus Leicester, who had a disappointing performance away at Old Trafford. Elsewhere, while City stumbled on Liverpool, one you had big wins from Spurs, Man United and Chelsea, and of course that hilarious business from Arsenal, which we'll come on to later. But Matt, your trip to Molineux for Chelsea 5, Wolves 2, good day at the office?
Yeah, it was so fun. I mean, watching Chelsea is just ridiculously good fun at the moment because you just get so many goals. Having said that, the first half hour of the game was as poor as you'll see. And then,
really?
Yeah, oh, dreadful stuff. There was like no shots at goal was the total after half an hour. And then Fikayo Tomori, with his first ever shot in the Premier League, scored the goal, which he will never better if he plays until he's 50. Yeah. And yeah, after that, Chelsea had some fun. And of course, the stat that's been tossed around quite rightly so is that every goal that they've scored this season has come from an academy player. And Tammy Abraham, obviously the standout. And you've got to start heaping praise on him in a way that hasn't been done previously because of the consistency that he's shown. He's scored two goals against Norwich, two goals against Sheffield United, and three here. You know, that's quite remarkable for a player who'd had a couple of games
four
in the
here,
Premier League before. Sorry?
Four here.
Yeah, quite. Yeah. Thanks to Kepa for that. But as good as Chelsea were at times in the game and the academy players took the spotlight, as I say, the Tammy Abraham thing really brought into stark contrast with me thinking about Dominic Solanke and the different paths that they've taken, because Solanke and Abraham played in the Chelsea youth team together, and Solanke got 42 goals one season and he couldn't agree a new contract with Chelsea. Cashed in, got a big one from Liverpool, didn't play for them at all, and yesterday he made his first start of the season for Bournemouth, for whom he's yet to score. And it just feels like another advert not only for the Chelsea academy but for the loan system that they use, because if you look at how Abraham has learnt and developed at Bristol City, at Swansea and at Aston Villa, he's a ruthless goal scorer, and Solanke's struggling to get a game.
For all of that, and the loan system's not often you hear someone praising it the way Chelsea use it, but for all of that, is it not the transfer ban that's really made the difference in this case?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, the great irony is they've got the transfer ban because of the way that they dealt with young players. But yeah, did they not have a transfer ban, would Tammy Abraham be playing? Possibly so, possibly not, but maybe Mason Mount wouldn't, and I'm fairly certain Fikayo Tomori wouldn't. But they do have the ban, and so they are playing, and Callum Hudson-Odoi and Reece James both played for the under-23s on Friday night, so they will be back involved pretty quickly, certainly in Hudson-Odoi's case. So for the moment, you know, there's plenty for Chelsea supporters to be happy about and enjoy ahead of Tuesday against Valencia.
Tuesday against rudderless Valencia, who got done 5-2 by a very hungry-looking Barcelona at the weekend. There's a broader point here about England's under-21 players. I know this because I read what you wrote about it, Daniel.
Yeah, I think 11 of the 23 that went to the European Championships this summer started in 10 in the Premier League and one in John Joe Kenny in the Bundesliga for Schalke this weekend, which is more than we've become used to. And I think the first couple of weeks of the season we saw it and we kind of thought, well, yeah, but will this carry on? But it is carrying on. And the transfer ban is Chelsea's best signing of the last few years. I honestly believe that. But Frank Lampard deserves a bit of credit as well, because on the bench yesterday was Olivier Giroud, who could easily have played instead of Tammy Abraham. Was Pedro and Ross Barkley, who could easily have played over Mason Mount, and Kurt Zouma, who could easily have played over Fikayo Tomori. So it isn't just as simple as these are the only players I have, I need to play them. He is actually making the right choices as well.
All right. So with Chelsea, it's all about the transfer ban, and with Wolves, it's all about the Europa League, Emma, is that right?
Well, yeah, apparently so. I have to say, I do think they're looking in a little bit of trouble, Wolves.
Oh, yeah?
They're winless in five now, I think second bottom in the table. And I just
think there is one team worse than them.
There are, which we will get to. But off the back of the weekend, it was the body language of the Wolves players that were on that pitch, especially after the Mount goal went in, I think it was, that I think was quite alarming.
What happened to their body language?
Oh, they just visibly dropped the players. Right. They were done in at that stage. And also some questionable team selection in that game. Nuno leaving out Ryan Bennett, I think, for what he said was due to shape and profiles. Vallejo made his debut. He's on loan from Real Madrid, who was very poor by all accounts. They conceded 8 goals in the last 2 games now, Wolves. So I think the alarm bells are ringing, certainly defensively there. But it's not only that. I think the midfield, which we've all enjoyed so much with watching Wolves, they look to have been to have dropped a lot as well. They're not servicing Jimenez the way they used to. They didn't really bring in another midfielder in the transfer window, which I think looks pretty clear and obvious now. And they're going into a period now, 7 games in the next 3 weeks. The games are coming thick and fast with them playing in the Europa League as well. And in terms of the league, 2 massive games now, Crystal Palace followed by Watford. That game against Watford, who knew, could have been a 6-pointer this early in the season at the wrong end of the table. So really, really critical time now for Wolves. I think it'd be interesting to see how many points they can get in the bag between now and the next international break. It's minimum 4, really, they've got to be looking at.
Mm. Right, Braga coming to visit on Thursday in the Europa League, a competition which they have so far won all of their games. And possibly it was you, Daniel, saying that, you know, at the end of the day, if they do have a great run in Europe but just kind of blow it a bit in the Premier League but stay up, that's actually not a bad way. That wouldn't give the supporters a bad season.
I think supporters would be happy with that. I think the owners, I think Fosun, have kind of got one eye on doing both. I think the reality is that Wolves have pretty much the near-perfect season last season. they're not playing as well now. I don't think they are a disaster, but they're certainly not playing as well. And it's fine margins in the Premier League. If you don't play as well as the perfection you achieved last season, you're going to start losing games. And the difference between 7th and 15th in the Premier League this season, I don't think will be huge. So games like this really do matter. I don't think they're a disaster. I just think they're slightly doing everything slightly worse than they were last season.
Interesting. Daniel, you've been part of the Totally Live shows. Is it true that back in the day you once also paid to come to one?
It is true.
Really?
Yes.
Which one was that?
I suspect it was the old regime. I think it was the old regime, yes.
Right, okay.
But yeah, I was not a football writer at that point. I was very much just a punter.
And you thought, if these guys can get paid for it...
Exactly, very much sold the dream to me.
Wow. If you'd like to enjoy a similar experience, listener, I'm delighted to tell you we've got four shows coming up. As you know, we're at the South Bank Centre quite soon, Monday, September the 30th. That's in London. In November, we've got back-to-back shows in Dublin and Belfast. That's the 8th. And Saturday the 9th of November. And then we wrap things up with Liverpool on Monday the 25th of November, when we'll be joined by Julian Lawrence, Raphael Honigstein and Duncan Alexander. And in similar names, they and other Totally Football favourites will be present at all of those shows. So great. If you'd like to know where to get tickets, well, thetotallyfootballshow.com/events has all the details. Daniel, another exciting football experience for you this weekend was seeing Spurs playing at home at 3 p.m. on a Saturday for the first time since December 2016. And when I say at home, obviously I mean at home.
Indeed, yes. After the Wembley experience. And it was a really important, easy win for Tottenham, because they haven't played well at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, really. They've scored two goals, I think, scored the first goal of the game twice, I think, in the first half at home. They've been really sluggish and slow to start, and teams like Newcastle have proven that you can frustrate them. Palace were complicit in their collapse, but they actually played really well, and they played really well without Harry Kane playing very well.
Where did this come from? Serge Aurier, how much of a role does he
have? He's better than Davinson Sanchez at right back. I think it came from the fact that Crystal Palace saw what Newcastle did and thought, we'll do the opposite. They basically tried to play really high at the pitch. Van Aanholt pushed on. Wilfried Zaha played on the right and kind of stayed really high up, which meant Danny Rose could just surge on however he wanted to. And Heung-min Son was the star. So, yeah, Mamadou Sakho played his first game, I think, for 7 months, and he was pretty wretched. So they caught Palace on a good day. But, an important win for Spurs.
OK, so not necessarily the template for a bold new approach for Spurs.
I kind of described it as a cobweb blower, which is what it felt like. It felt necessary, but not necessarily the immediate answer to all of their prayers. They've got a big game this week. That's the...
Away at Olympiakos.
Indeed. I think that's probably the toughest...
It's a huge game, that. Because Olympiakos, 5 of the last 6 English sides to go to Piraeus have come back defeated.
Indeed.
We should actually be speaking to Pedro Martins, the Olympiakos manager, in Tuesday's European Football Show ahead of... Because they're off to an amazing start to the season. 9 games across Champions League and Premier League, and they've won 8 of them, drawn the other, conceded 1 goal and scored 20.
Mr. Marinakis is enjoying himself at the moment. He tenuously segued into a Crowbard reference.
No, that's not tenuous at all. So the owners of Olympiakos are also imposing a similarly successful football model at Forest.
It's going well so far. It's similarly chaotic as well, but it is going very well so far. Yes, they obviously won away at Swansea this weekend. And are now 2 points off second.
First team to beat Swansea.
Mm-hmm.
If you only watch one football-related GIF from the weekend, make it Joao Carvalho's pass in that game. Oh, you won't regret it.
Why?
It's just gorgeous.
Very briefly on Forest, and it should be brief because I always talk about them, but they don't play another top team currently in the top 10 until November the 23rd. So they've actually got a real chance. They've had some tough games, games. They've got a chance now, which is when we flop. That's good.
We shall see. Matt, you'll be covering this and so much more in the Totally Football League show on Wednesday.
Yes, and we're going to have Chris Powell in with us, which will be a delight. Obviously, vastly experienced EFL manager, but more recently appointed to Gareth Southgate's backroom team. So we shall be talking to him all about that.
Lovely. If you could fill us in later on how the Cowleys got on in their debut for Huddersfield, that would be grand. Right now, though, Let's just have a quick word about Man United's 1-0 win over Leicester. A significant fixture, possibly a significant result. Not a great game, though.
No, going into the weekend, I looked at the fixture list and had no idea this would end up, what was it, second last on Match of the Day? Yeah. It was a pretty dull affair. The fact it was Rashford's penalty spot kick that was the difference between the two sides in the end kind of says everything you need to know. But for Manchester United, it was a really, really important win, even if it was just narrow in the end, because if they hadn't have won that game, they would have then been 10 points behind Liverpool after just five games this Premier League season. So it really does keep them in the mix, if you like, as we look at that at the top six. But I think Leicester will still be, well, they are, they're fifth. They'll be there or thereabouts. And ultimately, two cancelled each other out.
A lot of people disappointed that Rodgers didn't seem to have anywhere to go to in terms of the fact that his team weren't able to lay a glove on Man United.
Yeah, that's always been the accusation against Rodgers, that he lacks that plan B. In a way, our disappointment is kind of a compliment to Rodgers and how quickly he's improved Leicester. You know, if we'd have watched the Claude Puel team go to Old Trafford and lose 1-0, we'd have said, that's about right. Now we're saying, that's a shame. Mm. Shows how far they've come in, let's face it, only 6-7 months under Rodgers. But yeah, the lack of defensive certainty, you know, it was a defensive error for the goal, and then the lack of bite in the final third was a little bit disappointing, purely because Manchester United were so under strength.
Right.
Can I be massively contrary and say that I think Leicester are hugely overrated?
Okay.
Yeah, they've won two games this season, one away at newly promoted Sheffield United, one at home to Bournemouth. They rarely score more than once in a game.
Should have lost at home to Wolves.
Should have lost at home to Wolves, yeah. I think it's just one of those where people have picked up on the fact that they've got a decent manager and made a couple of good signings. And yeah, they might finish above Everton, but they're not going to be in the top six.
Daniel?
Don't believe the hype.
Hater, yeah.
Is this a Midlands thing?
Might be a regional bias painting that. But no, genuinely, I think, you know, they're going to finish somewhere between 7th and 10th. They're not going to worry the top four in the slightest, I don't think.
Yeah, but we have to kind of pretend otherwise.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Come on, mate.
Next up, the game that had the hashtag of what arse and a performance to match, I would suggest. Now, Emma, you were kind of obviously trying to keep one eye on this. Where were you anchoring Five Live in Salford?
Yes.
But somebody cut through the cables of Vicarage Road, so yes. You didn't have comms?
Yes.
You weren't the only one having problems with Leeds, eh?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, because Arsenal... Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Tell us about what you saw.
Yes. Well, from a Watford perspective, it ended up being everything we could have hoped for, minus the extra 2 points. It was a massive draw. Actually, now I've had time to reflect and sleep in it, I think there is an element of we're a bit gutted, couldn't take all 3 points, because it does mean we're still bottom of the table still. The main point about this Watford performance, you know, Arsenal have got a ton of problems we'll talk about in a second, but from a Watford perspective, this side showed intent. Which is what you want to see when a team is struggling. You never want to see players sort of downing tools. But they were certainly, certainly fighting. Unfortunately for Arsenal, there is still quite a bit of work to do in the final third. They need to be a lot more clinical with their finishing. But the stats were obscene with regards to chances Watford had.
Right.
My favourite came from good friend of the pod, Duncan Alexander. 2% of all shots this Premier League season came from Watford in the second half of that game.
Although we're only five games into the season.
Still, but when you think, that's a lot of games.
It is a lot of chances.
Yeah.
Moreover,
it has meant Arsenal have faced 96 shots this season, more than any other side in the Premier League, Serie A, La Liga, Ligue 1 and the Bundesliga.
Yeah, that's extraordinary.
So they were under the cosh.
Almost 100 shots in, what, five games? Mm. It's mental. Yeah. Zwi then asked Duncan if that was worse than the awful Derby team of 10 years ago. You guys will enjoy that question. Duncan, you're happy to know, replies, Derby in 2007-08 faced 82 shots only in their first five games. Arsenal way ahead of that. That's not the only category they're leading. No team has conceded more penalties since the start of last season, since Emery came in, nor made more errors leading to goals. And with all due respect to Watford, that seemed like the massive headline from this game. Arsenal just bishing it up repeatedly from the bat.
It feels a little bit harsh to draw such firm conclusions on the basis of a draw away from home, but this was Arsenal under Emery. This was bright promise, Aubameyang being brilliant, followed by structural problems and defensive ineptitude effectively and eventually causing their downfall. And I think it will be the end of Emery at some point this season. I defended him last season. I kind of, purely because he was taking on a project that had become so Arsene Wengered and required such a big spring clean. But he has the turnover in players at that club is extraordinary over the last 2 years. So he has a new squad now. There are no more excuses, and they're still making exactly the same problems. You know, we talk about the number of shots faced. They're actually getting worse. You know, things like buying David Luiz, the only player of his profile who could possibly make that defence worse. Things like making substitutions that don't look like they made sense at the time and end up undermining the progress. Things like the complete lack of defensive structure. And it's just so predictable now. And Arsenal fans are starting, if they haven't already, to think, hang on a minute, there are some managers out there out of work who might do a good job with this squad, might do a better job with this squad.
Allegri or that fellow Arsene Wenger.
Yeah, or the options which they were talking about before, which was the Mikel Arteta, Freddie Ljungberg, you know, backroom staff.
The Lampard approach, essentially.
Or you could go the other way and go for somebody like Ralf Hasenhüttl. But one thing I find amusing about Emery and a lot of managers in the Premier League this year is this new rule of you can pass the ball to somebody inside your penalty area. You don't have to do that. It's not, the rule isn't that you have to do that now. So that first Watford goal, there are three Watford players pinned on the edge of the penalty area and another one roaming around just in case. You just think, just read the situation and don't pass it to Socrates. He's going to get himself in a muddle and you concede a totally needless goal.
We want managers to have philosophies, and I think that's wholly appropriate. But if Unai Emery's philosophy is Arsenal, is committed to Arsenal playing out from the back, he will not be in charge by the end of the season because they can't do it. And they've repeatedly shown they can't do it. And every side knows they can't do it. They had 40 seconds to plan that passing out from the back yesterday, and they still managed to give it to the first Watford player that got near them. It's absolutely ludicrous. So if he's committed to that, then he's signing his own death warrant, I think.
It was an extraordinary performance in many ways by Arsenal. In the end, a disappointing result for the Hornets. We heard about Arsenal under Unai Emery. What about Watford under Sanchez Flores then? Emma, did you see any differences and how optimistic are you?
Well, I'll be honest. I was worried that the bounce had only lasted 15 minutes when Aubameyang started scoring. But it's looking good. Like I said, there was a lot of intent from that Watford side yesterday. The team selection, I'll admit the alarm bells rang a little bit. It did look quite similar to a Javi Gracia side. Still no Sarr, who was on the bench. No Danny Welbeck whatsoever. So we're not really sure why that was. Presumably not fit if he's not in the squad at all. But Sarr did come off the bench and make a difference. But I think life's looking good under Kike Sanchez Flores. If they can play like that going forward,
they've got to. I mean, that's second half, no?
Yeah, absolutely. And they've got to go to Manchester City next week, which isn't ideal at all. But off the face of it,
Norwich just
a wounded Manchester City and a Watford side that aren't afraid to press against top sides.
Exactly. And a City team that's going to be coming off a trip to Shakhtar Donetsk, wherever that fixture is going to be played, somewhere. Yeah. Wow. Who knows, eh? Who knows? Very good. Arsenal, meantime, have a trip of their own. They're going to be going to Frankfurt, who responded to reaching the semi-finals of the Europa League last year by selling off all their goal scorers. Oh, but they brought some in. Well, they brought in Bas Dost, Eurogoal legend Bas Dost. Anyway, we will talk about that, no doubt, in Tuesday's Totally Football Show. Some more games to bring you from the Premier League weekend. We'll touch on the exciting South Coast teams after this. Hey, listener, what are you wearing right now? Could it be a little smarter? Could it fit a little better? Well, the good news is we're sponsored today by TM Lewin, Britain's favourite shirt maker, who've sold over 30 million shirts since they started up in 1898. They produce the finest pure two-fold cotton shirts in the classic German street style, wardrobe essentials that every man needs. TM Lewin shirts are ideal for every day of the working week. They're great quality and even better value. You might say that they're Champions League shirts at championship prices. There's a TM Lewin design for everyone, so no matter your size or whether you prefer something plain or with stripes or a print, they have a style and a fit for you. Because you listen to the Totally Football Show, TM Lewin want to give you a bit of a treat. Right now, if you head to tmlewin.co.uk and enter the promo code TOTALLY at the checkout, you can get any shirt for just £24.95. There's free click and collect delivery to any of their 70 stores nationwide, so visit tmlewin.co.uk enter the promo code TOTALLY to get any shirt for just £24.95. TM Lewin, Britain's favourite shirt. Other games. Well, there's one coming up Monday night as Villa host West Ham. It is that way around, isn't it, Matt?
Yes, it is.
Good.
Claret and blue action.
Yes.
At exactly the same time that David Cameron's big programme starts on BBC One, which is wonderfully ironic given his West Ham Villa gaffe.
Well, right. Good for him, though, isn't it? Because he doesn't have to watch the game and decide, worry about who he's going to support.
A bit political, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, all sorts of excitements involving teams from the South Coast. Southampton, who won their third straight in all competitions. Third straight clean sheet as well. Remarkable. Going to Sheffield United, getting a 1-0 win there. Chris Wilder, again, very grumpy at full time. Also, we saw Bournemouth absolutely doing a number on Everton, the number being 3, to get Everton's 1. And Brighton pegged back at the death by Burnley. But all in all, pretty positive. Daniel, let's talk about the Bournemouth game, because that's a big result for a Cherry side who struggled so far this season.
Yeah, and a big result for Marco Silva as well, I think, because Everton are becoming this groundhog team that spends around £100 million in a summer and finishes 8th. They did it in 17-18, they did it in 18-19, and the way they're going with this kind of inconsistency away from home, they're going to do it again in 19-20. They've 1 point against Villa away, Palace away and Bournemouth away is not what Farhad Moshiri et al. Expect from Silva. I think it feels like we constantly need to have a manager under pressure, and I think now Marco Silva probably is that Premier League manager under pressure.
I see. Currently it's Bournemouth in 8th place.
Yeah, I do think Marco Silva is under pressure. Again, it was another poor away performance. And just the contrast between what they're doing at home and away. I think a lot of the fans are finding it difficult to place their finger on exactly why it's happening. But tactically, he was the same at Watford. He seems to be getting it a bit wrong at Everton. A lot of question marks yesterday over why he was starting Calvert-Lewin over Moyes Keane.
Mm.
There could be an injury issue there. He might have taken a knock that he's carrying. We don't know. I think he probably brought him on a bit too late in that game to make any real impact. And with Moyes Keane, there was so much excitement when they finally got their man. And half the reason he left Juve was he wasn't getting regular game time there. So for him to find himself sitting on a bench in a game like that until the 70th minute, it just seems very bizarre. If Everton are finally going to move forward, having spent all this money and not just consistently finish around the 8th place mark, they have to be winning games like this against Bournemouth away. And they're not. So I do think the pressure's mounting on Marco Silva. And I'm not saying it because I'm a bitter Watford fan. I think he's getting found out slowly but surely.
It's a cliche. We say these kind of games are won in midfield, but you look at the amount of money that Everton has spent. I like Fabian Delph. He's a solid footballer. But having Fabian Delph and Morgan Schneidlin as centre midfield pairing, Bournemouth had Philip Billing and Lewis Cook, and they were brilliant yesterday. Cook has got something to prove after a long-term injury. Philip Billing has got something to prove after a poor season with Huddersfield last season. But they were on it. They were intense, and they were fighting for everything. Delph and Schneidlin, it was just so passive.
It was just the other day on this very show that we were touting Everton as the new thing and Marco Silva as having proved the haters wrong. So what's gone wrong?
The reputation about his management has always been that he struggles to maximise a good mood. So every now and then a rotten away performance will come in and they'll lose someone. You think, well, it's like you've just not turned up for that game.
Right.
Which offers the, you know, offers the hypothesis that he struggles to motivate the players every week.
I see.
But
yeah, it doesn't seem like much. He's not a particularly dynamic character, is he? Which you probably get quite old quite early on. But Eddie Howe, that's the opposite. You know, never going to lose his job at Bournemouth. But are they going to do one of those things now where they'll win 4 games in a row? He'll get linked with the Spurs job. Then they'll lose 4 games in a row. Mm-hmm. And he won't get linked
Arsenal
with
it.
You're full
perhaps
of joy today, mate. Well, as it stands, it is Bournemouth who are up in 8th spot. Meantime, Brighton had that 1-1 draw with Burnley, and as I say, Sheffield United lost at home to Southampton. The goal in this one, though, second of the season for Gineppo. Oh my word, the boy's a bit special.
Yeah, apparently so. And one of those who comes into the team, unlike someone like Sofiane Boufal, who has a bit of baggage to overcome, comes in with that freedom to give it a go. And as we said about Chelsea, that's pretty powerful. If you've got that freedom and that faith of a manager, Ralph Hasenhüttl has said he will you know, there's a meritocracy here. I'll pick who impresses me. And yeah, he's taken advantage.
When you talk about Bouffal's baggage, what exactly do you mean?
Well, he was at the club. It didn't work out well. He went out on loan for a season, came back, was told he could fight for his place. But I think probably it's fair to say would have liked a permanent move away this summer, which didn't come. So yeah, he's slightly struggling for relevance there.
Very something nice. I need to add to that. Mm-hmm. Apparently you pronounce his name Jenipu.
Jenipu.
Jenipu. He's,
sounds like a practical
joke. We stood corrected yesterday. It's from the words of his mouth, Musa Jenipu.
Jenipu. Just on Sheffield, just on the Blades, breaking news. Saudi Prince has won a High Court battle for control of the club over Kevin McCabe, a lifelong Blades fan who says he's bitterly disappointed. He's got to sell his stake now to the Sheikh, Prince Abdullah, for $5 million. And I'm not sure, but what does that mean for the club? Is there disruption or is it?
You would think probably not disruption because they've got a great manager in place and the co-owners, as they were, have both been there for a while. It actually might work out in their favour because it's been a real bitter dispute between the two of them. So if there's one person in charge and a bit of clarity and harmony, it might work out in their favour. But, you know, who knows? Maybe this guy wanted to get rid of Chris Wilder all along and I don't know, bring in Steve McLaren or something, in which case not good.
I've got to say, if I was a supporter, I'd be slightly concerned. You'd rather have local participation, wouldn't you, in the ownership than a prince from the Middle East?
But, yeah, I mean, generally, you would rather that. But then ask a Manchester City fan, what would they rather?
And Prince Abdullah, he's not been a sideshow during their rise. He's been there, you know, he's been behind decision-making already.
Right.
It's just a more of a power coup, I suppose.
Okay, fair. Right, OK. Well, Villa and West Ham still to come on Monday night. But that pretty much wraps things up for the Premier League for now. We're still going to talk about the Cowleys, a little bit about Europe, WSL, all that sort of thing. But before any of that, it's producer Ben.
Thank you very much, Jim Boats. Lee Price from Paddy Power on the line, as always. And Lee, I want to talk about Europe for this section, please. Let's kick off with four English clubs and four English wins in the Champions League. And why don't you tell us who the overall favourites are, too?
Oh, Ben, that's so you. You're so patriotic. The numbers suggest that, yes, this is possible. Even performance over the weekend offer a mixed bag in terms of evidence. Let's start with the most probable, according to the odds. Man City away to Shakhtar. 2-7 they win there. They like that fixture and they should bounce back from the Norwich shock. Then it's Chelsea at home to Valencia. Not an easy game, but Chelsea in good form. Valencia in chaos after sacking their boss. 4-5, the Blues prevail there. Arsenal at home to Lille was 4-9. And then you've got the challenging one, supposedly according to the odds. Liverpool 5-4, to win against Napoli. We still do make them favourites though, as we do with the other three English teams. So a four-way there is around 8.5-1. And English favourites will be a recurring pattern this season, at least for the group stage. In the outright market, Man City are the favourites at 16-5. Liverpool second favourites 11-2, level with Barcelona.
And over to the Europa League, please, Lee. Not feeling quite so confident here. So let's look at draws for Man U, Arsenal and Wolves. And why don't you tell us who the favourites for this tournament are, too?
Yeah, the Europa League would be interesting, wouldn't it? Wolves, in particular, having struggled domestically, it'd be great to see what they're going to do on Thursday night. Their odds on to beat Braga, but it's 11-4 for the draw there, and we do fancy Wolves. Arsenal away at Frankfurt, tough game, but again, they are the favourites at 5-4. The draw there is 12-5. United at home to Astana, they're 1-7 to win this fixture. The draw's 13-2, the visitors 16-1, by the way. It'd be a classic recent United result, though, wouldn't it, not to win that. If you do fancy three draws in these games, Ben, it's 95-1, a lot of that coming from a United draw. And that's perhaps because they're our favourites to win the Europa League this season. They're 9-2 in the outright betting. Arsenal second favourites, a bit like the Champions League this, 11-2. Wolves, by the way, joint fifth favourites alongside Lazio at 16-1.
You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only. Terms and conditions apply. And when the fun stops, stop. Matt.
Yeah.
Apart of your busy weekend was doing Chelsea-Brighton in the WSL. How was
yes,
that?
Yes, it was. Yeah, it was a disappointing performance from Chelsea, I've got to say. Brighton, very resolute, dogged team under Hope Powell. That's kind of her trademark as a coach. Chelsea struggled to break them down and having a bit of a slow start to the season. They did beat Spurs, but weren't great in that game. And this is what cost them last season. They ended up
being a long way off the champions Arsenal because they had a difficult start. But Brighton were impressive, a fairly limited squad of players in a lot of ways, but they picked up Megan Walsh from Yeovil in the summer, the goalkeeper who made more saves than any other keeper in WSL last year. She had a lot of shots faced at her as part of that Yeovil team, and she made a big difference. She's a really assured presence for them at the back. But yeah, overall across the weekend, like we saw last weekend, there's no real wallopings going on, it seems, this season, which is a good thing. Biggest margin of victory, 2-0 for Man City at Reading, and Everton against Bristol City. Really worth looking at Chloe Kelly's goal for Everton.
The second in particular.
My goodness me. Yeah, two in the space of a couple of minutes. But
so, my kind of preconceptions, and ignorant as they are, about great goals in women's football would not have been that you'll get this consistent run of screamers from distance.
Yeah, it seems to be something that's happened in the first 2 weeks of the season in particular. A lot of players coming into the season with a lot of confidence off the back of good World Cups. Maybe that helps. Should also say Spurs won their first WSL game. They beat Liverpool by a goal to nil. Liverpool finished with 10 players in that one. And I think Birmingham are going to have a long and difficult season. They lost key players like Ellen White in the summer. Their manager Mark Skinner left halfway through last season. They're struggling a bit. They lost at West Ham. They've been beaten in their opening two games. But it's nice, and there's not a massive disparity between the top teams and the bottom teams, as shown by the fact that Chelsea couldn't beat Brighton, whereby they won 4-0, I think, there last season. And we've got Man United Arsenal tonight, which is a big game.
I'll say. Excellent. All right. Coming up then on Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday, of course, we're off to Europe, Emma, for Champions League and, of course, Europa League, of course. Which game, can I ask you, which one game are you most looking forward to seeing?
Oh, it's hard to pick. Well, first up, Liverpool's trip to Napoli, just to see if any of the players are able to get dressed.
I think this is a slight exaggeration about the state of the... Ancelotti wasn't happy, but they'll be able to get dressed.
It's difficult to look past PSG, Real, isn't it?
But yeah. Although Dortmund, Barcelona...
I was just about to say, I think for me that is my pick.
Right.
I have a sneaky suspicion Dortmund might do a job here.
Really?
Yeah, they won 4-0 against Bayern Leverkusen at the weekend, where they spent most of that game out of possession playing on the counter-attack, which would probably be very similar against Barcelona. Mm-hmm. And Jadon Sancho just must be licking his lips at this opportunity. He's been prolific so far once more for Borussia Dortmund this season. And I just think he'll be looking at this game and thinking, what another brilliant chance just to put his name out there.
Right. Although Barcelona had a pretty big win, as we mentioned before.
They did.
5-2 over Valencia.
That's funny in a way that Valencia treated Marcelino so badly and promptly conceded 5, which they never did under Marcelino. Yeah. In the first game afterwards. I mean, Barca were good, but it was an understrength Barca.
Yeah.
You know, with Fati, his second appearance, first start for Barcelona, scores after 2 minutes, sets one up after about 8 minutes.
Yeah.
Just look, the confidence of the boy, not man, was astonishing. Yeah.
In Tuesday's Totally Football Show, we'll be asking Alvaro about the comparisons that are being drawn between this 16-year-old prodigy and other prodigies that have come through the ranks at Barcelona, but... Yeah, Suarez coming on late, scoring, Messi watching on, not sure when he'll be returning, whether there's any question of him possibly being ready for this game, no.
I don't think he'll certainly don't think he'll start on.
There was a big return meantime for Paris Saint-Germain meantime, as Neymar suited up for the Parisians, much to the chagrin of their support, who booed him consistently through the game, right up until I think it was the 92nd minute, wasn't it, when he pulled off an incredible overhead kick to win them their game. Who was it against? Strasbourg. That's right. Matt, were you watching that one?
I wasn't, no.
Okay. But he's suspended for the midweek clash with Real Madrid, so it's possibly Icardi if they can get him fit for the game. He did make a brief appearance in the Strasbourg match. And Eric Choupo-Moting. So, anyway, we'll hear about all that stuff on Tuesday. Thursday, Jack Lang's going to be joining us. And in the course of which we're going to be asking him about Sergio Ramos's series on Amazon. Have you watched that, anyone?
I have read Jack's summation of it.
Yeah. Okay.
And I think it's probably better than the series, yeah.
All right. Well, that review coming up on Thursday. Matt, I did wonder, though, could you tell us a little bit more ahead of Wednesday's Football League show about how the Cowleys got on? Because it was such an interesting game for them to start with, for Huddersfield, against the team that they rejected, Sheffield Wednesday.
Yeah, and a team that also had a manager in the dugout for the first time for them in Gary Monk. And it was he was the happier of the two, 1-2-0 at Huddersfield. Gary Monk, a really interesting character, I think. There's this kind of controversy around him that meant that he left Birmingham, that meant that, you know, he left Leeds under something of a cloud. But Championship clubs seem to just gravitate towards him regardless of that. Sheffield Wednesday is a great job for him to get. But the Cowley thing, I find fascinating that people are so fascinated by them. I mean, they're brothers who work together, and obviously they've done a really good job.
Well, they used to be PE teachers.
Yeah, of course, and they used to manage just Concord, that, really. And since then their career's really taken off. But yeah, it's a really weird job for them to have taken, I think. I think to choose Huddersfield over Sheffield Wednesday, I'm not quite sure what the thinking is behind that, because Huddersfield already at this stage of the season, the aim is to stop them from getting successive relegations. I don't think there's any way, given the mood around the club and the quality of their squad, that they can even be thinking of a late push for the playoffs. So it's a really, really interesting move for them to have made, and it's going to be fascinating to see if it proves to be the right one, given that they could have gone to Sheffield Wednesday, which seems like a much more stable club on a bit of a better footing at the moment than Huddersfield are.
Interesting. Can we get a quick update on how Bolton are getting on after their trolley dash at the end of the transfer window?
Well, this weekend,
not so good. No, conceded 6-1
6-1 to Rotherham.
Yeah, they took the lead though.
Right, and then
yeah.
Excellent. All right, well, that's coming up on Wednesday. Jack Lang in on Thursday with Lindsay Hooper and Michael Cox. And Tuesday, of course, is our big Euro preview show. You're doing a football quiz tonight with producer Ben and Nick Miller.
Yeah, apparently so. TIFO football. I'm not quite sure why I've been selected. Although, Emma, we did quite well at the Opta one, didn't we?
We did.
Were you on a team
together? We weren't bottom by any means.
We were firmly mid-table.
I think, yeah.
With this kind of thing, you're never going to beat the Sky Sports stats guys or whatever.
Are they there?
If you can get podium, that's great. But we'd just be looking for a bit of respectability, I think.
Brilliant. All right. Emma, what are you going to be up to in the next few days?
I'm definitely going to be remaining horizontal after yesterday's heart failure of watching Watford, especially in those dying moments, having been on air for 6 hours. So
crikey,
that is my plan. Yes,
it's a long time to be on air.
Yes, well, especially when during the commentaries you're meant to get a bit of a break, but unfortunately, as you mentioned, there were broadcast issues at Watford, which meant I did keep having to pick up.
Did you do the commentary yourself then on that game?
No, other than when I was watching the screen and Aubameyang scored his second,
right?
Which I had to kind of sound marginally enthusiastic about.
Can I say that my worst broadcast, well, among my worst broadcast experiences, right up there with doing the live link up on BBC in the World Cup in France with a group of French people who didn't speak English, and of course my debut live appearance when I forgot, you know, the much missed Ray Wilkins' name in my first ever live appearance, have been the times when you're hosting a game and the commentary goes down and you have to fill in.
Yes.
Because I'm singularly ill-suited to that. Daniel, anything you want to flag up that we can read from the story Ouvre this week?
No, I'm at Chelsea Valencia tomorrow night.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
For the eye, and that's it.
Brilliant. All right. Well, listen, whatever you're up to in the next few days, make totally a part of your footballing experience. And many thanks for being with us today. Thanks also to Emma, Daniel and Matt. Hope you've had a good time with us, listener. We'll catch you soon.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, please email sales@muddyneesmedia.com. Keep up to date with everything across our Totally Football network at The Totally Show on Twitter. And make sure you check out our brand new website too, thetotallyfootballshow.com.